RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Imagine for a moment a world without textile design. 20th century history gave us a period of just that under Mao Zedong's oppressive regime during the Chinese Revolution, when all clothing became standardized so that the people would be seen as being patriotic. Plain, drab, grey tunic suits became the norm, and everybody looked depressingly uniform. Textile design helps us, both young and old alike, to express our individuality and also the spaces we live in and work in. My guest today has been creating textile designs for over four decades. She is Jenny Freen. With a childhood passion for drawing, it soon became clear that Jenny would be drawn to the creative world. And that journey continued through her time at the City School for Girls in London, then on to a foundation, Ravensbourne, followed by Hornsey College of Art, where she dodged the demos and sit-ins, and finally ended up graduating from the Royal College of Art in 1972. Very early on in her career, she had the idea of corralling a range of talented designers to add to her portfolio rather than just her work, as she felt it would have greater appeal to the many European design trade shows to present her speculative creations. She was correct in her thinking. Buyers loved the variety of a whole group of young British designers. As a 25-year-old, you would find Jenny weighed down with heavy portfolios, blistering hands, jumping on and off buses and trains, hurrying to keep appointments with the various buyers. These hard slogs eventually led her to form First 11 Studio in 1987. It featured her work and 10 other designers. It became a great success and ran for 31 years. In 2018, she closed the studio and scaled back to become solo as Jenny Freen Studio. Improvements in digital-aided production and a marketplace of social media have given her total control and ownership of her design output and direct selling to the customer. Each day you'll find her in the studio, along with her dog Rudy, doing what she's always loved, putting her imaginings to work. For this interview, we hooked up over the internet, and I began by asking Jenny to describe a typical day.
Well, I think my friends down here must think I'm mad. They probably don't quite understand it, but I do spend most of my life in the studio. So I get here after breakfast and I get stuck into whatever I'm doing and try to move around a lot so I'm not sitting too much, of course, and, you know, and then have a break for lunch. And then I always fit in a dog walk and anything that needs seeing to in the house, obviously I do, but mainly I'm here. I love it here. I love the smell of it. I love the messiness and the colours and I love everything about it. So as soon as I walk through the door, I feel this is where I'm the most myself.
Well, I worked out that talking to you earlier that you probably spend a good 8 to 9 hours a day in your studio, not including weekends. That works out to 2,300 hours a year.
Does it really?
So that gives you an indication of how long you spend in that place.
And then if you think I've worked every single day of my life with the odd holiday in between.
OK, so just describe your studio. You've just mentioned that it's, you know, you like the mess. So looking around.
Yes, looking around me. Well, it was a barn when we first moved here. It was airless, windowless, and it had a mud floor with an old sit-upon mower in the middle of it, about 150 years old. And so we had it sort of designed properly, and I overlook the cottage we live in, Christmas mm-hmm. cottage, and a beautiful catalpa tree, which I think I sent you a picture
yes,
of.
Very beautiful.
And tons of other trees. It's a very nice view. It's very green. It's very green, very sort of relaxing.
And your studio is adjoined to the cottage, yes?
It is. It's behind the cottage. It was a sort of an old barn when we moved here.
Where were you born?
I was born in the south of London. It was then Kent. It's now part of the great London sprawl.
And your father was Theodore
yes.
Harbridge and your mother was Isabel. So
something great names, aren't they? Theodore and Isabel.
Incredibly British and Victorian almost. But tell me a little bit about your early years. I mean, from when you became aware of things. Do you have siblings as well?
I do. I two sisters. I'm in the middle of three girls. And I think I remember my childhood as playing in the garden with my older sister. Endlessly. I think our mother sort of turned us out into the garden, you know, in the morning, and we would just be there all day and mucking around and being naughty and climbing trees. And
what did your parents do? What was your father's profession?
My father was a mechanical engineer. He had a consultancy in the middle of London. And my mother was a pianist. And she came down from Scotland when she was very young to go to the Trinity College of Music in Bond Street. So she played the piano a lot. She always said my father married her so that he could hear her playing the piano.
And did you follow in those footsteps? Are you musical?
Yes. I think I wanted to be a pianist for quite a long time until I was about 13 and the hormones kicked in, and then I refused to practice anymore. Decided I was going to be an artist instead. I always loved drawing.
So tell me about that. When did you first start drawing and being, for want of a better word, creative as a young girl?
I think when my older sister was a bit of a brain box, and with me it was always, well, Jenny will draw it for you. But, you know, that was quite young, so I must have been drawing and just enjoyed it and found it was something that I could do from quite a young age.
And why do you think that is? What led you to draw? Were you deficient in other areas, or did you just excel? Did you just naturally?
No, I just love drawing. I knew that I could get a likeness if I was drawing somebody, and I loved art at school.
You went to the City of London School for Girls?
Then near Fleet Street in Carmelite Street. You know, I was educated to the clack of the printing presses because it was so near Fleet Street.
Of course, yes. Fascinating place, really, actually.
Yes.
No longer, of course, because they've all moved out. No newspapers there anymore.
And the school moved it to the Barbican.
Were you at the Barbican at all, or was it always
always in Carmelite Street.
Would you say you were academically bright? I mean, at that?
I think I was pretty average. And I always loved the art room more than any other lesson. Art's what I looked forward to. And we had a wonderful art mistress called Mrs. Cardew, who was the wife of Michael Cardew, the potter.
Oh, right, of St. Yeah. St. Ives.
Yes.
Yes, I know. I've been to that pottery and many times.
She was amazingly inspiring. And you know what it's like, if you're good at something and you find something easy, that in itself is encouraging. And I did find it easy. And I couldn't wait to go to art school. I mean, by the time I did O-levels, as they were then, I was on my starting block to get to art school.
Okay, so you really sort of dismissed any other option. You were dead set on the creative world.
Absolutely dead set.
And did you know at that point what it was in the creative area that you wanted to pursue?
I think I wanted to be a fine artist. I wanted to paint. But at that stage, I had been going in my last year at school every Saturday to Sir John Cass, which was the art school that was then in the middle of an island in the middle of the road opposite the Tower of London. And Sir John Cass drawing classes on a Saturday were what sort of kept me going. I absolutely loved it. So when I left after GCSEs, my parents said, you should get an A-level. So you can go to Sir John Cass if you do an art A-level there. I did that in the following February, just 6 months after my O-level. I took the A-level art and got that, and then got into Ravensbourne on the foundation or pre-dip.
And so on the foundation, you would have explored lots of different areas, as one always does.
Strangely enough, I've got no idea why. Then, in Ravensbourne, if you went into the foundation, it was a specialised foundation. You had to choose. Strange. So I wanted to go into painting, of course, or fine art. And my father sort of, you know, sat me down and said, I think you ought to do something, you know, more sensible, something where you had some sort of skill. Or I think he thought that if I was going to be an artist, I'd be sort of starving in some garret somewhere. So, you know, and what about textiles? I hardly knew what textiles was, you know. I hadn't done it at school or anything. The day I walked into the foundation course, it was into a room full of table looms, and I took to it like a duck to water. I absolutely loved it. I mean, in retrospect, I think I probably would have loved anything that I'd done. I could have gone into graphics or it was weaving, and there I stayed for the next. I was at art school for 8 years, so I was there for the next for six more years after that one.
I mean, you moved on in the 60s to Hornsey, didn't you? And that's where. Mm-hmm. So were you at Hornsey during the sit-ins, or was that? Oh, you were there earlier?
I was there during the sit-in.
Because that was 68, I think, wasn't it? 1968. Yes. So did you get involved in that?
I slightly. I was never terribly political. I think I enjoyed the good bits of it, and I didn't get terribly involved in.
They sort of locked everyone out, more or less, didn't they? The sit-ins and the various things that
yes.
they had prevented.
Yeah, so there were all sorts of fun things going on at the same time, like sort of all-night poetry readings
yes.
and lots of playing table tennis. And and then I think I went home and sort of sat it out at home and waited for it all to blow over. And then started, you know, in the second year, and it had all calmed down by then.
So you were a revolutionary, clearly.
Clearly.
I think fairly early on, you got married, didn't you?
Yes, I was probably the only married person at the Royal College. I got married at the end of my first term to Patrick, who I'd met on foundation at Ravensbourne. He was doing graphics there. You know, I don't know why we got married so young, but we did.
So now we're on to the Royal College.
Yeah.
And interestingly, so many faculty members have been to the Royal College.
When I was at Hornsey, the Royal College was like a castle on a hill with a sunset behind it. You know, it was up there looking magnificent, and it was there, you know, I wanted to go. I absolutely had to get in there, and I think I was really lucky to get in. I loved it there.
Well, I'm sure you did. So you started off going back once, or when you were Hornsey, you say you were weaving.
Yes.
And of course, that is a very classic thing to do. It goes back to Neolithic times. That's around 12,000 years ago. But you actually sort of moved on to printing, textile printing. And
no, I did weaving all the way through my BA at Hornsey. And when I went to the Royal College, I specialised in jacquard weaving.
Oh, yes. Explain that to the listeners.
Well, jacquard weaving is very technological. The jacquard loom is the loom on which you can weave figurative designs, like damask or something like that. So instead of being just warp and horizontal and vertical, warp and weft, each warp thread is on a weight and can be lifted individually. Each warp thread can be lifted, and you have work it all out on graph paper. And when a warp thread is on top of a weft thread, you fill in a square on your graph paper. So you can imagine, I'm sure it's now all done on computer, obviously, but then we had to do it by hand. So you can imagine how big the graph paper would be for a decent sized repeat. It would be huge. Have I made that clear?
Yes, you have.
When you're actually weaving, the jacquard looms at the Royal College, and there were six of them, and I had them all to myself. It was just wonderful.
Why? Were there no others?
Everybody else was doing ordinary weaving, dobby weaving, but nobody was interested in doing jacquard except me for some reason.
Wow, so you had all that.
But I had
yourself.
All these machines and the technicians.
Oh, even
there
better.
They were great. They were the two technicians there. I got more help from them than anybody else, because you know at the Royal College they leave you to your own devices a lot.
Yes.
You don't get an awful lot of teaching. They were fantastic. Bill and Jim, I mean, I've never forgotten them. They were just my saviours.
I remember saying to one of my daughters when she went to Central St Martin's, always be nice to the technicians. Because if you're nice to them, they'll be very helpful.
Helpful.
And she remembered
yes.
that, and they were very helpful. She
yes.
was very nice to them.
Exactly.
Because I think they're often a kind of forgotten breed. They're the people that can make things happen and show you
yes.
how things work. And,
yes.
And that's really important. After the Royal College, what I read, you had a period abroad for a while, did you not?
What happened was, I swiftly found out that I wanted to be freelance. I didn't want to be tied to any company.
What made you decide that? Was that because you'd heard bad things about people being sort of captured within a company and just, you know,
I think
on
it
the
was
treadmill?
Just an instinct. I think I just wanted to be free and to be able to work with different companies and not be tied to any one particular one. And so I thought, okay, I'll become a print designer. And I became a print designer overnight.
Moving from, you know, as you've described already, weaving, which is one, how did that transition across to print? Because it's a completely different thing.
Yes, but because I'd done jacquard, I'd been thinking figuratively. I hadn't been at the Royal College. I hadn't been designing damasks. I'd been sort of weaving Snoopy and, you know, all sorts of weird imagery and thinking figuratively rather than like Mary Restia, for instance, in vertically and horizontally.
Yes. Okay, so you leave the Royal College in 1972, I think.
Yes.
And so then you set off on your freelance career.
Yes.
And you start to get yourself involved with various companies in Europe.
The first thing I did was I went to an enormous fair in Frankfurt called Interstoff, you know, the big fair grounds in Frankfurt, where
yes,
all the big shows are.
Was where the book fair used to be, and when I was in publishing, I went there on several occasions.
And I just literally hawked a folder of designs around with me, and you know, went onto the stands and started to chat it a lot and said, "Can I show you my work?" And that literally how I did. Then I came back and decided it would be much more fun to have other people to work with. I liked from the beginning the idea of a team. I think a team is, you know, has more strength, and it's just much more fun to work with other people, isn't it? Don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Even if it's just to, certainly in the world of graphic design, there's nothing better than after work, you either have a drink and you start bitching about the industry and everyone in it and what people are doing. It's really cruel, but it's part of the fun.
Yes.
So you started your company at the time, Jenny Free.
Jenny Free and Associates
at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, really quite early on. So I'm interested to know how you set that up and what the arrangements were with the various designers that you embraced within the association. How did it work?
I found a couple of my ex-tutors and a couple of my contemporaries and a couple of friends and then a couple of other designers who I thought were good. And I said, come on, let's all get together. I mean, that's how it happened. And they sort of must have trusted me from then that I was going to do it properly, that I was going to do a good job for them.
Tell me, how did the administration of the whole thing work? Were they were all freelance?
Yes.
They were not working with you in your studio. They were, how did the business side, if you like, work? Because it's very entrepreneurial for you at quite a young age to decide to bring in, and you went on to expand the whole thing, of course, a little later. But I mean, I'm interested in, that's a side of you that is quite different, because you're a designer at heart, as you've said. You loved drawing as a child, you knew what you wanted to do, and then suddenly here you're now in a business proposition, so you're becoming a kind of mini entrepreneur.
I've never thought about it that way. It's funny, it just seemed to be an obvious way of doing it, because if you have, you work in a very weird way as a freelance textile designer. I can't think of any other discipline that works in this way. You work speculatively. You work first, and then you sell your designs on to fabric manufacturers. You work in collections, and then you show your collections, and they pick out what they like. So it made sense to me that if I did a collection, then I had, you know, several other collections from other designers, that I would be showing a much wider spectrum of work. And so I thought, well, then, you know, you balance it. You have, you know, you don't have people who do similar work. You know, you have people who do things that are very different one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all got to be of a certain standard. They've all got to be good designers.
Were you personally in charge of those presentations to those?
Yes.
So you were acting almost like an artist agent, if you think of the world of illustration.
Yes.
So in addition to your own work, you had this little coterie of other designers.
Yes.
And you would bring the, you constructed a business of that. How did that work? I mean, did you set up a limited company or?
Later. It became a limited company. But in the beginning, it was very sort of free and shambolic, probably. Mm. You know, I would put, everybody would do their collections. They would go into, you know, those, you know, big black portfolios. Mm. I would go off to, say, Italy, to Como or something. I would get huge calluses on the inside of my hands.
I bet you did. Hauling
these, I was sort of 25 or something. And it didn't seem to matter. I'd be walking for months. I could never afford a cab or anything. I would be walking from one address to the other with these heavy A1 or A2 portfolios to, you know, the ceteries, the silk companies in Como. And they absolutely loved it. They couldn't believe, they loved the idea that, you know, here was this, you know, English girl who is arrived and had all this fabulous work.
Wow, I should think with this array of different designers, it would have been quite magical. Yeah. Because normally you'd see just one person's approach to a subject. Mm. And so that was successful? Presumably
so that was successful, and I you know, my confidence grew, and so I started going to America, and it just went on from there. I started going to Germany, and by the time first 11, it's difficult in the beginning, and then as you go through, you know, people get to know you, and you begin, you know, you have a reputation. And it gets easier and easier.
There's a little interruption that I'm interested to know whether it's true or not. I was in the library a couple of weeks ago, and I picked up a copy of Who's Who, which is always very useful. And I found your entry. And it tells me that between 1984 to 1986, you were a portraitist. Is this true?
Did it say that in Who's Who?
It absolutely did. In print, yes.
Oh gosh, how funny.
Is that an untrue?
No, that's absolutely true. Oh dear. Yes, it was between Jennifer and Associates and First 11.
Exactly.
I actually decided
what
I was
happened?
Going to...
you got fed up with lugging around those big portfolios.
And I closed First 11 down. Okay. And I did it for a bit and then thought, Jenny, what are you doing? And so I'm not ever going to be a great painter. I mean, so I started up First 11 Studio. It was in 1987.
Right, okay. So this was a kind of lost 2 years in your
career. It was
career.
A sort of lost 2 years, yes. And didn't think you were going to ask me about
no,
it.
No, well, I was fascinated to discover that.
I'd always wanted to be a proper artist, a painter, or, you know, to do fine art. And I think I'd been doing textiles for, it was 10 years or something. And I thought, am I going to do this for the rest of my life? Or shall I try doing portraiture? Because I love drawing so much. And so I closed the studio and started drawing, mostly people's children. And very quickly realised that it was very difficult, not very well paid.
I know artists that are full-time, and it's a different life. It's hard, and you have to do it 110%.
Yes.
You can't be, you know, one moment a graphic designer and then think you can become a painter. It just doesn't work out. And it's surprising the number of people that seem to feel that they can just move across and...
Yes, you know exactly whether you can do it or not. I mean, people have said to me since 2018, why don't you paint, Jenny? You know, come on, you'd love to do that. And I know I can't, because I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to meet my own standards. If I'd done it for the last four decades, I would probably be able to do something that I thought was good enough. But if you haven't done it, you of course you can't do it.
Let's move on now to 1986, when you founded First 11 Studio and had 10 other textile designers involved.
Yes.
So that was now suddenly quite a big deal. And I'd like you to tell me a bit about that and the people that you had working with you and how it operated.
I did it in much the same way that I'd done Jenny Farina and Associates. I found, sort of sought out designers whose work I really love.
Who were the other 10 that made up?
The 11 of us.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say that would be in the second half of the 90s and the early part of the 2000s. And there was me, Patrick. There was Sue Bodnay, our agent, and we had a girl called Katie who did our administration. Then we had, Mary Restio, wonderful weaver, Sarah King, embroiderer, Sarah Battle, who trained as a printmaker. She's such a quirky designer, quirky, sort of very witty, beautiful, beautiful imagery. David Van Berkel, very clever designer. Rebecca Hoyes, energetic. Sally Lloyd Thomas, Lisa Saunders.
Mostly women, two men, I think, in there.
No, only David there.
Well, that's good. That time, all women. I mean, that's incredible.
I had to find designers who reflected my own ethos.
Yes.
You know, my sort of design ethos is sort of, not necessarily simple, but clean, uncluttered, energetic, balanced, with high awareness of colour. Always colour, very important.
Yes.
So I had to find people who reflected that, but also added their style and their own handwriting, and who would, you know, broaden the look of this collection, which probably took about 2 hours to look through. If you can imagine looking through something like that for a couple of hours, an hour and a half, 2 hours, you had to keep people interested and excited about what they were looking at. And so the broader and the more different things that you were showing, the better. And that was really... basically the whole reason for having this wonderful team. That's the important thing, finding the right people to come in whose work balances mine and the other people in the group. So we had the weaver and the couple of embroiderers and the printmaker, and then the rest were printers. And everybody who came in knew that, well, that's how it started. It was a careful selection, if you like, and then a balanced selection of really good designers.
By this time, were you at your present location?
No, I was in Peckham, and 4 or 5 years after that moved to Camberwell.
Were you working alone in those studios as before, with the other designers just dropping in, and or did you have anyone working in the same space?
Most of the time I had one or two designers working in my studio with me. I always had, yes, one or two. It wasn't until I came down here out in the sticks that I've been working on my own. I had an assistant here for about four and a half years, but apart from that I've been on my own.
So this is the property that you looked at, I think, did you say 90 when I spoke to you the other day?
And
some huge amount of
yes.
properties before you hit upon what sounds idyllic.
And having
seen one or two pictures, it is idyllic.
It's idyllic country cottage. It was, I think, the 94th house that we'd looked at. I mean, lots of them, you know, you just cruise past and thought, no, that doesn't fit the bill. And I saw this and it was a coup de foudre, you know, it was love at first sight.
Well, it looks like the perfect location for a Rich Curtis film to me,
yes.
You know, for the American market that would swoon over the whole thing. So you built yourself your studio next at the back of your house.
Yes.
And that is where First 11, you were running First 11 for nearly, I mean, not there, but the company ran for almost 30 years.
It was 31 years.
Which is a long time.
So it was half the time in Camberwell and then half the time here.
So did anyone join you down there in the country, or again, were they...
No, because, I mean, we'd been the same people in First 11 had been in Camberwell, and there's very little change among the people in First 11. I mean, some of them were there right from the very beginning. A couple were there right from the very beginning.
Presumably when that ended after that 31 years, those other designers had to go off and do their separate thing, or maybe
yes.
they'd started to do that automatically over a period of time. But I mean, how did it all end?
Well, you'd have to ask some of them. We were all sad. I think I probably burst into tears when I said we were closing down the studio. It was all changing so much. Everything had become so computerized, and the companies were beginning to work in different ways. People were starting to put their collections online, and you know, companies would scroll through collections on a computer.
Yes.
And I never liked that. I never liked to do it. I never liked to, always liked to, you know, to show textiles. So people need to see it and sometimes feel it and get a sense of, you know, what a textile really looks like. But you can't tell from a computer screen. So I always said no. People said, could we see your designs online? I would say, no, we don't do that.
It's funny because although the digital age has brought so much to everyone in the creative fields, you know, it's made things easier and so forth. To my mind, we've also lost a lot. So for example, I always loved, certainly in my field, which is graphic design, I always loved the geographical differences. For example, the way it used to be, and I sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but the way it used to be is that in graphic design, you didn't see what was going on around the world until there was an annual or an article about someone's work in New York or wherever it might be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to, it was sort of delayed gratification. But what it also did was to keep the geographical differences. So you knew a bit of Swiss design because it was so clinical and minimalist. And you knew a piece of American design because it was so witty and bright and had, you know, chutzpah. And
mm-hmm.
and British was always in between. It had a little bit of the continent and it had its own feel. And that all went because suddenly you could see everything that was going on 24/7. You know, somebody could upload something that they just finished instantly. And that's made a kind of mishmash now. And you don't see those differences so much anymore because they're all everyone is looking at each other's work and they're being inspired by it. And so you get this kind of smorgasbord of design. And I think that's a great loss.
I think so too. That there's what's it called, Pinterest, like a sort of soup of everything. And I think that's where so many people go to look for ideas. And so it all becomes a circle of...
Well, that's true. In fact, when I was running my studio, obviously we became digital, but I'd say to them, for God's sake, don't look online, you know, to get ideas. You know, go out, you know, go out. Go to a bookshop, go to the library, go to the park.
Exhibition,
do anything, but for God's sake, don't. And also embrace all of the creative disciplines. I was a great believer in that. One of the things I used to say is never hang out with graphic designers because you just all be, you know, navel gazing.
Yes.
You know, you've got to go and look, go to exhibitions, go to the theatre, go to the opera, go to see gardens, everything, because it will affect you.
I agree.
I think that the internet really has beaten us all because I think that's where most young designers go. I think it's very sad. Anyway, you didn't really embrace digital technology at all.
I did for myself for designing. You know, I ended up doing, you know, designing on the computer or mixing, you know, hand work. And
because I think the work that you produce now, which is illustration, abstraction to a certain extent, some of your work, looking at it, you vary around. Some particular things you've produced recently, which I think are very witty, are the napkins with the squared, torn pieces of fabric printed in a flat colour in different colours. It's funny, you know, you've got this immaculate piece of folded and then you've got this ragged edged piece, but it's lovely. Yeah. And so that to me is a line print in graphic design terms. So how are you producing those?
When you're working with other companies, you have to have no ego at all. You hand over the copyright with your design, and that means relinquishing all your rights to that particular idea. So the difference now is that all my ideas are my own. I'm not selling my ideas anymore. I don't have to think about what the companies might want to buy. You know, I can just do what I feel like. That idea with the linen, I could never have sold that idea to anybody because nobody would have thought it was commercial or sellable enough. Do you see what I mean?
I do indeed, yeah.
So now I'm having fun. I'm doing things that I like and that I can produce myself because of digital printing. I can now get things printed up. I get them printed up and all. And then I get them made locally into product like, you know, napkins or whatever, cushions or whatever. And
so you're now a totally self-contained business.
I mean, self-contained
in terms of the design and the ownership of the copyright, but obviously manufacturing needs to be externally produced. So you have connections with various companies. That do your printing and make your cushions and so forth.
Yeah.
So you're you sell online on your own website.
Yes, and lots to friends round here, and there are little shows round here.
Do you sell through any other outlets, or is it purely now?
I've started a collaboration with a company called Collagerie, which is quite good news, and that's just happening at the moment.
So going back to the beginning where I asked you what's a typical Jenny Freen day, just tell me how you get your sparks of inspiration. So, for example, the idea I was just discussing, you know,
that idea isn't new. It's something that I dreamed up years ago, and I tried to sell it to a company, and they were very enthusiastic about it, and we went a certain way along the road to it going into production. And all the sales team got cold feet and they decided it absolutely wasn't going to work and they were against it. And so it was a damp squid. Nothing happened. And the idea sort of sat in my brain, I suppose, for ages and ages. And it suddenly popped into my brain about a month ago or 6 weeks ago, whatever it is. I thought, I know, I'll do that.
Well, that's great. The lovely thing about being in control of your own destiny. I think it's, you know, going back to, if you like, fine art, you've got to produce work that you personally love.
You have. That's the crucial thing. That's what I used to say to everybody in First 11. Because most companies like mine used to feed their designers trends and what's going on in the marketplace. Here are the colours for, you know, next season. Here's this and here's that. And I never did that, apart from the occasional tip. I would try and encourage them to do what they love. If you love it, it'll be good. If you love it, someone else will love it too. That's the most direction that I ever gave them. And somehow it worked. It was wonderful.
Has the last year and a half now, probably more, isn't it, the COVID situation affected your, I suppose, being where you are and being just you, you've been sort of just carrying on as normal, I should think.
Just carrying on as normal, yes. I mean, it's been quite strange, but I think it's been the same for everybody. Everybody, you know, we've been less social and walking the dog more, or I don't know, just watching more Netflix.
So what inspires you? Where do you get your inspiration from?
I've always loved music and I love gardening, and I walk for probably an hour and a half every day with Rudy, my dog. Yeah. And I put on my Audible book, and I stick that on, and I walk, and I'm happy bunny, taking lots of photographs, probably like you do. Do you listen to Audible as you go?
Well, I listen to podcasts or music, and I didn't want to forget your passion for book cover design.
But then, I have a passion for all sorts of visual things, though.
Well, I mean, that's a very specific one. Because you have a whole collection on your Instagram, don't you?
And Pinterest.
Pinterest, yes, the very thing that we talked about that you damned. I said people swiping through, you know, that's not the way to do it. So I'm interested in passion for. Is it because you find them inspiring for your own world or what?
I don't know. I love that combination of, I think, type and, you know, an image with type in a small format is just perfect format for design. It's book jackets, isn't it? They are so special. And I think being married to a graphic designer, you know,
of course.
I became very graphic aware, whereas I might not have done otherwise. I might not have noticed, but so much.
And I think you have a soft spot for Japanese design.
My father was born there.
And, oh, really?
He only came over when he was 10. He came over back to England to go to school. But when the family, eventually the rest of the family came over, lots of artifacts and things came with them. And, you know, around our house, there are lots of little sort of odd Japanese bits and pieces. And I always loved, right from early on, you know, I loved looking through Japanese textiles and the colours and everything, you know, just inspiring.
Towards the end of these little conversations, I always asked pearls of wisdom you might have for a young person wishing to enter into the same world as you, which has obviously changed quite a lot, as you pointed out.
Yes.
It's probably much more aggressive now, and with this idea of people flipping through like Tinder, looking at fabric designs and saying, well, I like that, I don't like that. What would you say? Is this still a good profession to...
I don't think I would encourage anybody to do it in this way. I think what they're doing now is, you know, they're setting up their own little businesses, and if not that, going to work within one company. I guess if you want to do it the way I did it, you've got to be prepared to work incredibly hard. You've got to be prepared to not be worried about having a sort of design ego, because every design you do ends up with another company's name on it. You never see your own name on your own design. And I think there are better ways. I mean, you know, it is sort of 40 years on, isn't it? I think there are better ways of going about being a textile designer now.
What's your view of textile design today?
Fabric companies still need to get their designs from somewhere. But I think what they're doing now much more is that they have their own in-house design studios, and they take graduates from colleges into the company, and they give them so many months internship or whatever, and then if they like them, they would keep them on, and then if they didn't, they would sort of take on someone else.
So do you think the individual talented creative textile designer is a thing of the past?
I think the talented individual textile designer, because of digital printing and all the things it's possible to do, would probably want to set up their own company producing fabric.
Is there much of that going on?
I think so, yes. Yeah. With everything it's possible to do on social media, you know, with Instagram and Facebook, I think, you know, if you look on Instagram, there are thousands of companies that are working and selling themselves that way.
Well, thank you for that wise advice. Jenny Freen, thank you for sharing your RDI insight.
Thank you, Mike.
That's all right.
It was fun.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, There are over 50 more featuring royal designers from a wide range of disciplines, talking about their life and work. Just type RDI Insights-RSA into your browser and you'll find them.